know. Might be a good time to visit, Kern said.
You reckon about 2 weeks ought to do it?
Sounds about right.
Bill nodded and went to his shop. I straightened. The neighbors are running for the hills.
In the 4 years you've had your office here, nobody broke into any of their shops,
Curran said.
None of them ever got hurt by any of the magical crap. We protected the street. Now they can give us a break by clearing out while we get this sorted.
Help me get him off the street? I asked. He picked up Mr. Tucker and carried him to the sidewalk in front of Cutting Edge. I knocked on the door of my office. Teddy Joe swung it open. A very human Conlon in his arms. I took him. My son yawned and groggily smacked my face with his hand. I hugged him to me, went inside the office and sat in a chair. I just needed 30 seconds to steady myself.
You want to tell me what this was all about?
Teddy Joe leaned over the table. Someone sent me a wooden box full of ash with a rose and a knife in it. Apparently he wants a response. Derek walked into the office and went to the supply cage where we kept bleach, gasoline, and other fun things we used for cleanup.
Who sent it? Why? What does the box mean?
Teddy Joe asked. It probably means war.
Are we getting invaded?
Maybe.
Who's invading us?
I don't know.
But you must have some idea.
If I did, I would be doing something about it. In your experience, do I typically sit on my hands when someone is threatening the city?
Can you at least tell me what kind of magic this is?
Why do you think I would know? Teddy Joe pointed in the direction of the unnamed square.
Because that was an elder power. When someone has a problem with an elder power, they come to you. You're an expert on evil old shit.
I'm trying to decide if I should be flattered or insulted.
If they sent you a message, they must think you would understand it. If you don't get it, ask somebody. The city is going to hell. People are getting boiled. People are being burned alive, and you're sitting here. You're the Inshinar. Do something.
Curran loomed next to Teddy Joe. His eyes had gone completely gold. I hadn't even heard him come in.
Uh-oh,
Conlon offered. Teddy Joe realized that now would be a very good time to stop talking and clamped his mouth shut. Curran stared at him with a singular predatory focus. Teddy Joe straightened and took a step away from the table. I am the Inshinar, I told him. I'm not omniscient or omnipotent. I'm not a god. If we want to get technical, that's your department. He didn't say anything. I took a piece of paper and drew the sign from the box on it. What does that look like to you?
A bra, Teddy Joe said.
That's our only clue as to who sent the box. Have at it. He blinked at the sign for a bit, folded the paper in half, then again, and stuffed it into the pocket of his jeans. Do you still have the corpse bus? I asked. Teddy Joe ran a mortuary. It catered to a specific clientele, most of them Greek neo-pagans, and a lot of his income came through his side business, making and selling human freezers, autopsy tables, and body transporting cars. He scoured junkyards, customized his equipment, and rented it out to the city and the surrounding counties. Teddy Joe grimaced.
It's not a corpse bus. It's a multiple recently deceased efficient removal vehicle. You do realize that spells murder?
Derek asked. Teddy Joe gave him a look.
Yes, I do. That's the point.
Angel of death humor. What would we do without it? It would really help if you could get the murder bus, load these bodies up, and deliver them. Teddy Joe's eyebrows rose.
Where?
Everywhere. Drop a couple at Biohazard, one to the pack, one to the casino, one to the witches. Anyone who should reasonably be made aware that these things exist. Give one to the order to, what the hell.
What do you want me to tell them?
Teddy Joe asked. Tell them that these things attacked us. There is something wrong with them, and we need to know where they came from. You want to help? Do this, please.
I'll get the bus, he said.
Miraculously, the phone worked for Curran, and he got through to the pack on the first try. Dolly promised to be right there, and she was bringing Doolittle with her. His next call was to the guild. He called the med mage and insisted on her coming to Cutting Edge to patch me up. Curran and I had reached an understanding. He didn't protest when I ran headfirst into danger, and I didn't argue when he then unleashed a crew of med mages on my wounds. The med mage arrived half an hour later, chanted my wounds closed, warned me to take it easy, which we both knew I would ignore, and left. Dolly was still in transit, which wasn't surprising. Right there in post-shift Atlanta meant about an hour, maybe two. We used the time to gather the bodies, chain them together in case they rose after death, sweep the ash into an airtight plastic bin, and feed Conlon his second breakfast. I tried to give him cereal. He flipped the bowl and put it on his head. We made the fatal mistake of laughing, and he decided the bowl was an essential accessory and refused to give it up. He also decided that cereal was clearly beneath him and spat it out in various creative ways. Derek ran down the street and came back with a smoked turkey leg from a vendor. Faced with two options, hungry Conlon or Conlon full of turkey meat, I went with the latter. Teddy Joe returned with the bus. Curran, Derek, and I started loading the bodies while Julie purified the street. When we were down to three corpses, a pack van turned around the corner and came to a stop near us. Dolly jumped out from the driver's side, swung the rear doors open, took out a folded wheelchair, then picked up Doolittle. For a moment, they made a slightly comical figure, a tiny Indonesian woman with thick glasses carrying a middle-aged black man about twice her size. Then she set him gently into his chair, and Doolittle surveyed us. Curran and Derek were holding two furry bodies. Teddy Joe and I were locking manacles on their feet. Julie had doused the street with gasoline and set it on fire, holding the hose ready in case it got out of control. And Conlon presided over it all from his high chair in the doorway of the office, completely naked with a half-eaten turkey leg in his hand and a plastic bowl on his head. He saw Doolittle and waved the turkey leg at him.
Vadanda!
Why me? Dolly didn't blink an eye.
Where is Yufeng?
He's inside, Julie said. I'll come with you.
She gave me the hose and they hurried into the office.
Bada!
Conlon squirmed in his chair. Stay, I told him.
Dabada!
Don't talk back to your mother, Curran told him.
After the fire burned itself out, we loaded the last body, except for the one wrapped in chains, in our jeep, and the spare I'd stashed, chained, into our office body freezer. Teddy Joe drove off, and I went inside. Yufeng looked about the same. What's the prognosis? I asked. Doolittle turned to me.
He's stable. He's in a healing coma.
How long will it last?
I don't know, Doolittle said. An hour, a day, a century. He might wake up when our grandchildren are old.
Great. Is there any way to wake him up?
Yes, Doolittle said. We can drown or suffocate him. He might wake up, or he might die. If he does wake up, his healing process may be irrevocably interrupted, and he may still die.
Is there any scenario in which he won't die? Julie asked.
Yes, Doolittle said. Let him sleep.
I rubbed my face. My only witness was doing a version of Sleeping Beauty. Maybe I could scrounge up a Prince Charming to kiss him awake.
There's something inside him, Doolittle said.
What do you mean?
There's a foreign object inside him. He might have been stabbed with it, or perhaps it's something he has put inside his own body for safekeeping.
Shapeshifters occasionally took advantage of their rapid regeneration in weird ways. Before Andrea accepted her true nature, she'd had an amulet that blocked her power embedded in her body. Yufeng might have done the same. Could it be keeping him in a coma?
Possibly,
Doolittle said. Should we get it out?
Not unless you want to risk his life.
Ugh!
You're not waking him up,
Dolly declared. It sounded a lot like an order. I looked at her. She stared straight at me, her eyes unblinking behind her glasses. A green sheen rolled over her irises, trying to dominate. 2 years as Beast Lady had taken their toll. I stared back.
Let me know. What?
When you remember that I'm not a pack member, you're not my alpha, Dolly. Turn the headlights down. She glared at me. I waited. I lived with a former Beast Lord. My husband hit me with the alpha stare just this morning after I told him that I was throwing his old t-shirt away. Apparently, as long as it had an intact collar, he considered it a usable garment, no matter how many holes it had.
You're not waking him up, she repeated, this time softer. No, we're not.
Although I'd have given a year of my life to figure out what he was fighting in the clouds, risking his life for it wasn't worth it. Does he have any family? Anyone we should call?
His family let him rot in a poacher's cage for years while they sliced pieces off him to sell on the black market. I doubt they will give a damn. We'll take care of him at the keep, Dolly said. No, Julie said.
Dolly ignored her.
We're best equipped to handle this.
I don't think so, I told her.
I don't need your permission, Dolly said.
You have no grounds to take him. First, he isn't a member of the pack, Dolly. You would be kidnapping a citizen of Atlanta. Second, Yu Fong fell and made that lovely crater because he was fighting something in the clouds, something ancient and magic that was aware of the boundaries and of my power, because once I showed up and shifted magic to shield us, it took off. It will come back to finish the job. Sheltering Yu Fong will make the keep a target, and you don't have the power to oppose it. Jim won't let you keep him. She opened her mouth. Third, Doolittle just said that there is nothing he can do for him. Am I right? The med mage nodded.
We can only make him comfortable.
So there is no pressing need to take him to the keep. Dolly pushed her glasses back up her nose.
I really hate you sometimes.
Welcome to the club.
He is special, she said. Sacred.
Yes, in the same way she was. I'm aware of that. That's why I'm taking him home with us, where I had wards and friendly homicidal neighbors to back me up. You're welcome to visit any time you like, but you're not taking him to the keep because you'd call me less than an hour after you got there and ask me to come pick him up. Let's not move him more than necessary. He's under a lot of stress as it is. She thought about it.
Who's going to be watching him?
Adora. Dolly wrinkled her nose.
Is she capable of watching him? You know how she is. What if she sees a butterfly?
I'll pay her. A few months ago, Adora had figured out that when she did a job for the guild, she earned money, which she could then spend however she pleased. After she had repeatedly shown the money to me, and I confirmed several times that it was indeed her own money, she went out shopping for the first time, and we got to find out what $1,200 of candy looked like. She ate candy for 3 days straight, then spent the remainder of the week on our couch with a stomachache. Now she worked as a merc, with the highest job completion ratio in the guild. She took her gigs absurdly seriously. Through rain, shine, sleet, and hail, purple corrosive slime bubbling up from the sewers, or mysterious black snow that sparked when it hit metal, Adora would get it done. Dolly knew that.
Okay,
Dolly said. Her tone told me she didn't like it. That was okay. I didn't like a great many things, but the universe didn't give a crap, so I didn't see why it should bend on Dolly's account.
You will take the best care of him, right?
No, I'll drop him into the nearest sewer and throw dirt on his head, she sighed.
I've got almost 2,000 smartasses to manage every night. Just tell me you'll take care of him, Kate.
He went to school with Julie,
He's been to our house. He isn't a stranger. Of course I'll take care of him.
I would have taken care of him even if he was a stranger, but she seemed like she needed more reassurance.
I'll hold you to that, she said.
You should growl a bit to let me know you mean business, I told her, just in case you think I might miss the point. She flipped me off. Love you too. I turned to Doolittle.
Can you please take a look at Conlon?
Doolittle gave me a look.
I saw him on the way in. He appeared to be in perfect health.
I know, but...
Doolittle held up his hand.
Kate, the last time you brought him in was because he fell off his feet.
He had a bump on his head.
The time before that you mistook heat rash for chicken pox.
I understand, but something happened.
Something always happens. Your son is a healthy, active toddler. He is supposed to run, fall, climb, and occasionally try to eat things he shouldn't. Your job is to keep him from the worst of it. It would do you and him a great deal of good if you just let him be a child and stop wasting my time.
He turned to Dolly.
I'm ready to go.
Dolly stuck her nose in the air and opened the door. Doolittle wheeled himself out. Curran and Conlon watched them go.
Thanks for the backup with Doolittle, I told Curran as the van pulled away.
He grinned at me. Something crunched. I turned. Conlon spat half a turkey femur out of his mouth.
Told you,
my husband said.
Cooked bones, Splinter.
Ah!
Chapter 7
That kid drives like a maniac,
Curran said. We'd set out from Cutting Edge in two jeeps at the same time, but Julie and Derek had left us in the dust. I couldn't even see their vehicle. That's what happened when you let a vegetarian half-blind were-tiger with a passion for racing cars give your child driving lessons. We turned onto the road leading to our street. She hasn't wrecked so far, I told him. An explosion of blood-red fire shot up above the trees on our left. Curran gunned it.
Please don't be our house. Please don't be our house.
We took the turn at a dangerous speed. The house came into view. A charred metal wreck sat on the curb in front of it, the inside of what used to be the Jeep on fire. Derek stood by it with a fatalistic look on his face.
Damn it.
3 minutes, Curran growled. They were unsupervised for 3 minutes.
Apparently, 3 minutes was plenty of time to blow things up. Curran stepped into the driveway, shut off the water engine, and jumped out of the Jeep. I followed. The stench of burning flesh and fabric filled the air. Ash floated gently on the breeze.
What the hell happened? I asked.
Your aunt happened, Derek said. Oh, no. She freaked out. Derek said.
Amber light shone from his eyes. He was not happy.
As soon as Julie and I got out, she made this red fireball and blew up the Jeep. Was the creature's body in the Jeep?
Curran asked.
Yeah, and my gear. And Julie's.
She'd blasted the Jeep
and probably drained herself down to nothing in the process. It would take her several days to recover.
Well, I'd wondered if she'd recognized the creature.
I guess that answered the question. Was anybody hurt? I asked.
No,
Derek said, his tone flat.
The Jeep was the only casualty.
I'm sorry.
At least she'd let them get out of the car.
Where is she?
In her dagger. She won't come out. Julie's with her.
Derek reached out toward the wreck and pulled back.
What are you doing?
Curran growled.
My knives are in there. Get the hose,
Curran told him. Derek strode toward the house. I pulled a sleepy Conlon out of the car seat. Will you take him? I need to go and give Era a piece of my mind. Curran opened his arms and I deposited Conlon into them. Once we were done with this, we'd have to install Yu Fong into the bedroom downstairs, and I'd need to track Adora down so she could babysit him. The phone rang as I climbed the stairs to the second floor. Curran came in and headed into the kitchen. I heard him pick it up and braced myself. I was getting as bad as Pavlov's dog.
If you call me again, I'll find this Sunshine Realty and shove your head up your ass.
False alarm. Era's room sat in the heart of the house, on the second floor, evenly removed from all the entrances. Daylight streamed through a single window, cut by the silver bars into a lattice. A breeze stirred the long gauzy curtains. In the middle of the room, Era's dagger rested in a wooden holder on the table. But my aunt wasn't in it. When she withdrew inside the blade, the dagger emitted magic, like a warm hearth. Julie leaned against the wall, her arms crossed. Where is she? She nodded at the balcony door. I glanced there and saw Era on the covered balcony, standing with her hands wrapped around herself. Usually she manifested in blood armor, but lately I'd been seeing her in long dresses, sometimes the color of ruby, sometimes white or deep rich emerald. She wore the red one now. I left the room and went out on the balcony with her. The 500-acre wood spread before us, verdant and filled with life, the trees rising in a solid wall just past the deer fence. My aunt looked tired, her gaze fixed on something distant on the horizon. For a while we stood next to each other, without saying anything.
You must call your father, she said.
No. She turned to me.
War is coming. Our enemy is coming.
Roland wants to kill me. He wants to murder my child or kidnap him. I don't think he's decided which yet. I just found out this morning he's mobilizing his forces.
This is bigger than that.
Nothing is bigger than that. I saw a photo of Razor today. He was just a few miles north in the city limits. He's here because my father wishes him to be. That Fae wears a coat made of the skins of creatures and people he's murdered. He isn't going to add a piece of Conlan's skin to his wardrobe. She reached out and touched my face. Her translucent fingers brushed my cheek, the magic prickling along my skin. She'd punched me with her power almost every week, but her caresses were so rare I could count them on my fingers. I shut up.
Stubborn child, the Queen of Shinar said. Your world will burn until everything turns to ash. You'll live through unspeakable horrors. You'll see everyone you love fall, and you'll wish you were dead. But you won't die, because you are the Princess of Shinar, the beacon of your people's hope. And if you succumb, that hope will perish with you. Your memories will become your torture. You'll carry that burden with you as you wade through a sea of blood, and when you emerge, you become me. Your victory a hollow trinket. I cannot watch you suffer through it. You and that boy are everything I have. You are the family I lost and found. Call your father. Show him the creature. Tell him the Yeddemoor are here. Together we have a chance. Do that for me in Shinar. Do that because I'm your aunt and you love me.
I walked out of the house carrying my backpack. Curran was still holding Conlan. Derek hosed off the jeep, while Julie watched with a skeptical look on her face. The four of them looked at me.
Did you talk to Era? Curran asked.
Yep. Come with me, I told Derek. I need your help.
With what?
With carrying a metric ton of firewood. I'm going to call my father, and I need to be out of my territory to do that.
Gave her a piece of your mind, did you?
Curran asked.
How did that work out for you?
I don't want to talk about it. Julie snickered.
Your mom got her butt kicked, Curran told Conlan.
Keep talking. See how that turns out for you. Curran grinned.
There you go, Conlan. If your mommy is ever mean to you, snitch on her to your great aunt and she'll fix it.
Conlan giggled. I growled and got into my jeep. I stood on top of a low hill and surveyed the pile of brushwood and dead branches Derek and I had arranged into a 10-foot-tall cone. At my back, the sunset died slowly as the sun rolled to the west behind the city. The rays of the setting sun set the world aglow, and against the curtain of light, the ruins of Atlanta stood out, dark and shadowy, a mirage of a safer time.
"Hi, Dad. It's me.
I know you're trying to kill me, my husband and our son, but guess what? All is forgiven. I need your help."
"Ugh, I'd rather walk on broken glass."
I was stalling. "I came here. I built this damn pyre. I had to get it over with."
"Do we need more wood?" Derek asked.
10 feet high, about 6 feet across.
Good enough."
"No." I reached into my pocket, withdrew a packet of dried herbs, pushed a couple of branches aside, and sprinkled it into the middle of the pyre. I replaced the branches, struck a match, and lit the newspaper. The fire gobbled up the paper, jumped to the smaller twigs, and began eating its way through the branches. The sky was cooling off, darkening from near turquoise to a deeper indigo. Hints of the first stars appeared above us. I concentrated on the fire, funneling my magic into it. The flames caught the herbs and crackled. Blue sparks shot up from the pyre, and thick aromatic smoke drifted through the air. I pulled a small vial of my blood from the pouch on my belt and poured a few drops into the fire, murmuring the incantation. Bright crimson burst within the blaze, spreading to envelop the whole pyre in unnatural red flame. Magic pulsed. There. It was done. The ancient words rolled off my tongue.
"Nimrod! Father! I need your help! Please answer!"
Well, look at that. I didn't even choke. Nothing. Derek drew back. The hair on his arms was standing up.
"Father! Speak to me!"
Nothing. I switched to English. "Father, we are facing a terrible threat. The Yetimur are here. I need to speak to you. It's important, please." The flames remained silent. I sat on the grass.
"Maybe he can't feel it," Derek said.
"My family has used this method to communicate for thousands of years. He can sense the fire. It's like a ringing phone, difficult to ignore. He just decided not to pick up." Derek sprawled on the grass next to me, looking into the flames. Most of the times when I looked at him, I saw a man. But right now, with the fire dancing in his eyes, he was a wolf.
"Do you miss him?"
he asked.
"Yes.
No matter how monstrous he is, he's still my father. I miss talking to him. When he lived close, I was angry with him. But there were moments when we just talked. In those moments, he forgot to be a conqueror and a tyrant. He was just a father, one I never knew during my childhood. And he was proud of me, especially when I managed to stick it to him. I was the child of a monster, from a family of monsters. My aunt had burned her way through ancient Mesopotamia. She had committed atrocities, and I had learned to love her too. There was light in Era. There was also darkness. And when I looked deep into both, I recognized myself. Roland loves me as much as he can ever love a child. He just loves himself more."
"I miss my father," Derek said, "before he turned loop."
After Derek's father turned loop, he'd raped, killed, and eaten his wife and daughters until teenage Derek finally snapped and killed him. He was the sole survivor of that massacre, and once he was done, he set fire to the house. That was how the pack found him, mute and unresponsive by the smoldering wreck of his family home. It took Curran months to coax him back to the living.
"What was he like?" I asked. "Strict. People said he was a good man. He was scared."
"Of what?"
"Of everything." Derek looked into the flames.
The way I grew up, there were Christians, and then there was the world. The world was evil and wicked, and only the Christians were good and safe. They talked about it almost as if it were a foreign power out to get them. One time, when we went to a mountain fair, and a visiting preacher delivered a sermon, he said it was easy to be a Christian when you hold yourself separate from the world. But if you do, there is no temptation, no struggle, and nobody to witness to. That our duty was to go into the world, holding the light of our faith like a torch, and to help others.
Didn't go over well with your father, did it? I guessed.
No. He pulled us out of the crowd and told us the man was a false prophet. Everything of the world was bad. Books, toys, school, anything that conflicted with a clean life.
I didn't know what to say. Christians aren't the only people who do that. There are shapeshifters in the keep who never go into the city. They don't want to interact with anyone who isn't a shapeshifter. Some people cling to their tribe, Derek. He took good care of you. He must have loved you. Derek shrugged.
I got the feeling it was less about love and more like a second job. A man works and takes care of his family, so my dad did that, because he was supposed to do it. We were his responsibility, and it was his job to provide and to make sure we turned out good and Christian. The plan was that I would grow up and turn into my dad, work at a paper mill, or, if I got ambitious, learn to weld or be a plumber, marry some girl, put a trailer on my parents' land, have kids, stay in the mountains with other good Christian folk, stay safe. I didn't want to be safe. I wanted to be a sailor.
Why a sailor? He grimaced.
So I could sail away from the mountains. I wanted more.
Now he'd gotten more, way more than he'd bargained for.
My father never had a lot of patience, Derek said. Maggie, my older sister, argued with him. She could argue forever. He'd keep it up for a while until she got to him, and he'd order her to her room. Then he'd go bust wood in the back, ashamed that he lost his temper. But he never laid a hand on us. After he turned, I saw him fucking Maggie's corpse.
My stomach turned. Loopism drives people insane. You know this.
Maybe there was always darkness inside him. Loopism just brought it out into the open.
If there was always darkness inside him, he never let you see it. Doesn't that make him a good man anyway? Derek turned to me. His eyes were empty. There was no sadness, no anger, just the watchful emptiness of a predator. I'd seen him do this before. That's how he dealt with it. He went deep into the wolf. Voron was the closest thing to a father I had, I told him. He fed me, he taught me, he cared if I lived or died. The witches told me that the only reason he did any of those things was because my father fried him with her magic. She cooked him until he loved her above everything else. When my father killed her, Voron couldn't handle it, so he raised me to become a weapon against Roland. Voron wanted to hurt my father. Either I killed my father, or he killed me, and either way, Voron would be satisfied with the pain he caused. Derek waited silently. I chose not to worry about it, I told him. I filed it away into the same place I keep things like Earth is a globe and ice floats. I'm aware of it, and when I need it, I'll pull it out and dust it off. But until then, I have memories of my childhood when Voron took care of me. They are my memories. I decide how to view them. So I choose to remember him as the man who raised me and taught me to survive. It makes me happier to remember it that way.
But is it the truth?
I don't know. He's dead, so I can't ask him. You can remember your father as a man who hid darkness inside him,
Or you can remember him as a flawed man who loved his family and died when loopism took him over. You have to decide for yourself what you can live with. A flash of white light split the ruby flames of the pyre. I stood up.
What do you know? Daddy Dearest decided to pick up the phone after all.
The light coalesced into a man. He wore a long robe with a hood. No, not a robe. A cape, lined with wolf fur and fastened with a thick gold chain across his chest. The white fabric draped his wide shoulders, falling down into the flames. And he was not my father, not even a little bit. The man lowered his hood. He was tall, at least 6'6", maybe 6'7", Caucasian, blonde hair falling in a long mane on his shoulders. An ornate torque clasped his neck, heavy with gold. Handsome face, broad with a square jaw, defined cheekbones, straight nose, and sharp eyes under a sweep of thick blonde eyebrows. The eyes glared at me with regal arrogance. The pale blue irises glowed slightly. I couldn't tell if it was from the flames or if his magic made them luminescent. He opened his mouth. Tech crashed into us. The man and the crimson fire vanished. The flames went out, and the pyre collapsed into a heap of ash. Okay, then. Derek leaned back and laughed. I gave him my hard stare. He didn't even notice.
Does this magic fire come with a warranty? Because I think it's defective.
It's not defective. He shook with laughter. Go ahead. Get your giggles.
We drove an hour and a half out here. Spent 2 hours scrounging for wood and building this fire, and we got the wrong guy. Did you screw up the area code?
You should take your show on the road. Make some extra money with all these jokes. He laughed harder.
Is this a regular thing? I'm just wondering, did your family usually try to call Attila the Hun and get Genghis Khan instead?
I'm not going to dignify that with an answer.
Maybe you should try calling him on a regular phone, Derek suggested. I can help you dial the numbers, you know, do the heavy lifting. Will you quit?
He sprawled on the grass on his back, snorting.
No!
I'll buy you new knives if you shut up.
I don't want new knives. I want my old knives.
He raised his head.
Give me that jerky you hid in the glove compartment and I'll stop.
Deal. He rolled to his feet, hauled a drum of water from the back of the Jeep, and dumped it on the ashes. We got into the Jeep, and I handed the jerky over. The sounds of a hungry shapeshifter eating filled the vehicle. I steered the Jeep toward Atlanta. Derek paused his chewing.
That was something, though. Some god or king or something.
I nodded. There'd been power in those blue eyes. I would have to ask my aunt if the fire call could be intercepted and who would have the magic to do so. He chuckled.
What is it now?
You can tell he had a whole speech prepared. Now he's probably fuming somewhere.
That's what worries me.
I'll always have your back, Derek said, even with the creepy magic.
I know. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We rolled toward Atlanta, where isolated electric lights beckoned, promising the illusion of safety.
Tell me again about the blonde guy,
Corinne said. Tall, muscular, expensive cloak lined with fur and fastened with a gold chain. Full of himself, perfectly brushed hair. I drank my tea. We sat in the kitchen. While I'd been gone, Kern had put our son to bed. He and Julie had already eaten dinner. I grabbed a late bite, too. Julie sat across from me at the table drinking her own tea. Derek had retrieved his knives from the burnt wreck of the Jeep, had spread a length of canvas on the table, and was painstakingly cleaning them. Most of the blades had made it through the fire, but a couple of synthetic handles had melted.
Don't forget the dog collar, Derek said.
Not a collar, a torque, I said. Collars open at the back. This one opened from the front.
What kind of a torque? Julie asked. Scythian? Thracian?
A heavy, ornate, with three stylized gold claws.
And you're sure it wasn't your dad in disguise?
Curran asked. Yes, the eyes were different. My husband crossed his arms.
How long did you gaze into his eyes exactly?
About 3 seconds while I waited for him to speak. I pointed my teaspoon at him. I know what you're thinking. Stop thinking it.
Julie kept a straight face, but her eyes laughed at me from above the rim of her cup. Derek appeared stoic.
What am I supposed to think? First, someone sends you a red rose.
And a knife and a box full of ash.
Exactly. Is it a threat? Is it a conditional declaration of war?
I shrugged. Maybe it's a gift from a socially awkward horticulturist.
Julie laughed into her tea. Derek pretended not to hear, but the corners of his mouth curved up.
Sure it is. Then you call your dad and some golden-haired pretty boy shows up dressed to impress.
I waved my spoon. I agree with you there. Nobody prances around in a fur-lined cloak in the middle of Atlanta summer with perfectly brushed hair. It looked like he sensed my fire call, put on all of his regal things, prepared a speech, and only then cut in.
And then tech hit.
Derek flashed a quick smile.
Curran leaned on the table.
So you tell me how I'm supposed to feel about that. On top of everything else, your aunt blew up the Jeep and overextended herself.
My aunt had a very difficult time manifesting during tech, and with most of her power spent on that firebomb, she would be sleeping for a while. I'd tried her dagger when we got home and gotten only silence. I spread my arms. How was that my fault?
I never said it was. I'm expressing my general frustration with this situation.
I'm frustrated, too. I've got Serenby. 200 people are gone and their families have no answers. I've got dead Mr. Tucker, Yu Fong in a coma, ancient creatures popping out of my aunt's nightmares and attacking us, my dad mobilizing, and on top of that, there is a Fey assassin running around in our city, likely hoping to kill you, me, or our son, preferably all three. My cup runneth over, and I have zero answers. Zilch. Nada.
We stared at each other.
We could spar, he said. We will both feel better.
Yes, I needed to punch and kick and do things so badly my limbs ached. That's a good idea. No, that's the best idea ever.
Someone knocked on the front door. Derek sniffed the air, picked up a large knife, and hefted it in his hand.
What? I asked.
The pervert,
Derek said, and started toward the door.
Oh, no, you don't. I'll get it.
I beat Derek to the door and swung it open. A man stood on our doorstep wearing gray pants, a light gray button-down shirt rolled up to the elbows, and tired, dark shoes. Bald, average height, average build, unremarkable features, neither handsome nor ugly. You'd pass him in a crowd and never give him a second glance.
Simon. In his neutral form, a clean slate for a polymorph, who could impersonate any human on the face of the planet? Behind him, a dark van with tinted windows waited in our driveway. I checked his eyes for the usual sharp intelligence. It was there, together with apprehension. What's the emergency?
Emergency?
Simon raised his eyebrows. Yes, what bad thing happened to make you show up here? What did you do?
Nothing.
I rubbed my forehead. My husband is generally frustrated, and so am I, so it's in everyone's best interests if you tell me why you're here quickly.
Simon hesitated for a moment.
I don't have a body.
I reached out and touched his shoulder with my index finger. I've just conducted a field test, and it appears you do have a body. Good night.
I didn't get a body. Biohazard, the Order, and the Pack received a body. I'm the best arcane expert in Atlanta, with a state-of-the-art lab, and you haven't sent me one.
Oh. I didn't send you a body because you would charge me an arm and a leg for it.
There were way too many puns in that sentence for my liking.
I am not interested in your services. Your price is too high.
Simon took a deep breath, as if he were about to jump off a cliff.
I'll examine it gratis. I pinched my arm.
A hint of the old Simon's arrogance crept into his eyes.
Really, Kate, this is childish.
I turned back to the kitchen and called out. Simon is here and he wants to help us for free. Derek clamped his hand to his chest and dropped to the floor.
Oh, gods! Julie waved her hands. Hide the children! The apocalypse is coming! The werewolves are fainting!
Simon spared them a single glance.
They were perfectly reasonable before. This is the result of prolonged exposure and proves my theory.
And that would be?
You're contagious.
Julie rushed over to Derek.
No, no, that's okay. He hasn't fainted. He just has the vapors. False alarm.
Simon looked to be in physical pain.
None of this is funny.
All of that ability to transform, and you can't develop a sense of humor? Cheer up, Simon. The ice of Jotunheim is far away. Your folks won't know if you crack a smile.
Simon sighed, opened his mouth, and froze. His gaze fixed behind me. I glanced over my shoulder.
Curran loomed in the hallway. My husband had a talent for emanating threat simply by standing still, and right now he was exercising this gift to its full extent. If menace were heat, the walls around me would have caught on fire.
I'm here to help, Simon said quietly.
Derek rolled to his feet. What's the catch? I asked. What do you want? I don't want to owe you anything.
Nothing. No strings attached.
There were few absolute truths in this world, but the fact that Simon never did anything without expecting a payoff was surely one of them.
Can you transform during tech?
Curran asked. Simon drew himself to his full height.
Yes. Good. Come inside.
Excuse me.
Simon stepped into the hallway and walked past me to the kitchen.
His furriness was so laser-focused on the blonde dude, he was willing to work with Simon.
And this wouldn't end badly, not at all.
Kate tried to fire call her father tonight,
Curran said.
Fire call?
Simon asked me. Later, I told him.
Someone cut in. I want to know what he looked like,
Curran said.
Can you do this?
Simon smiled.
Of course.
Good. Julie, get the Polaroid camera.
Simon rubbed his hands together. The skin on his face crawled as if a pool ball rolled under it. My stomach screeched in alarm and tried to empty itself.
Really?
Derek raised his eyebrows.
He's a weird pervert, but he is our weird pervert, and he came here to help.
Let him help, I said. Derek frowned. Curran gave him a hard look.
When you have to, use every resource available.
Ready when you are,
Simon said. There was no escaping it. I sighed and started. Square jaw.
5 minutes later, my fire call visitor stood in front of us. He was still wearing Simon's clothes, but the face and hair belonged to the man in the fire.
Yeah.
Derek volunteered.
That's him.
Curran examined him, his jaw set. Julie snapped a few pictures.
You didn't say he was handsome.
Thanks, just what I needed.
He was handsome, but there was something wrong with him.
In what way? Simon asked. His eyes were... I struggled to describe them.
Cold. Not exactly flat, but remote. It was like looking into the eyes of a gator.
Interesting,
Simon said.
Does he look like any ancient you know?
Derek asked.
Nimrod and Astamor are the only ancient humans I've met in person,
Simon said.
They don't exactly wander about like stray cats.
I got up. I'll be right back. If I come back and our guest is injured, I'll be very put out.
Julie opened her eyes as wide as they would go.
Injure? Us?
I went upstairs and brought the box down.
I need you to look at this. Simon collapsed into his neutral shape and examined the box, lifting the lid with his long, slender fingers.
Is this an artifact?
It was left on my doorstep. I told him about the boy burning. The more I talked, the deeper his frown grew.
To burn a body alive, but make the human immune to the pain, he murmured. How would you even begin to go about it?
I don't know.
If this is a message, there should be some way to attribute it. Unless this being's arrogance is so great they believe they would be instantly recognized.
My aunt indicated the box as a generic way to declare war, I explained.
And you found nothing in the box or on the knife?
Nothing except this shape. I drew the symbol for him.
Arsenic? Curious, he murmured.
I have a body for you if you're still interested, I told him. I took one to show my father, which was one of the reasons the trip had taken so long. We had to stop by the office and pull the spare out of the freezer.
I am.
Curran followed us to the jeep and carried the body bag wrapped in chains to Simon's dark van. Simon and I watched him.
Why are you doing this? I asked.
We've had our ups and downs. We are associates, sometimes business partners. To your father, I'm a bag of magically potent blood. He chained me in a stone cell with a barred, narrow window. Every day at sunrise, your father's soldiers would walk into my cell and shatter the bones of my legs with a hammer so he could take full advantage of my regeneration. I couldn't slow it down. My body would rebuild my bones and make more blood, and every evening the soldiers returned to drain it. I sat in that cell, staring at the sliver of the sky, and I knew nobody was coming for me. I would be there until I died.
We'd had this conversation before, but I didn't want to interrupt to remind him.
Then Curran came and pulled me out of that cell because you asked him to.
Simon wouldn't look at me, his gaze fixed on something distant.
I still have nightmares. There are nights when I keep a light on, as if I were a child. I
pictured him inside his ultra-modern apartment with his lab, his art, and the trappings of his wealth on the top floor of an enchanted tower, flicking the lamp on. Oh, Simon. Simon glanced at me, and there was sharp green ice in his eyes. He didn't look human. He looked like a creature who had risen from a place where ancient ice never melted.
I can't leave the city. If I do, your father will find me. This will never end unless you stop him, so I will do whatever I can to help you.
Curran stuffed the body into Simon's van.
I'll let you know what I find out,
Simon said. We watched him pull away.
What do you think that was all about?
Curran asked. I think he's scared of my father. He wants revenge.
Think he'll sell us out?
No. Besides, if you can't trust an ice giant driving a creeper van with a dead body inside, who can you trust? Curran chuckled. He knows this whole street houses shapeshifters, and none of them are his fans. He drove into the mouth of the beast in the middle of the night.
Odd. I'm surprised he didn't call ahead.
He couldn't, Curran said. I broke the phone.
How?
I crushed it.
I turned and looked at him. Curran prided himself on his control, especially now that he was a father. He didn't punch walls, break furniture, or scream. Even his roar was usually calculated. As much as I pushed and annoyed him, I'd only seen him lose control beyond all reason once. Watching him hurl giant boulders off a mountain was a memorable experience, but he had never broken anything of ours before.
Why did you smash the phone?
I was trying to put Conlon to bed and it kept ringing.
That is not okay.
I know. It was an impulse.
You don't give in to impulses.
What's going on with you?
Who knows,
Curran?
Your dad is getting ready to attack us. That damn Fey assassin is running around in Atlanta. People are being boiled. Some ass is sending you boxes with flowers and knives and delegations of screwed-up monsters. Our son was crying, and that idiot from Sunshine Realty called again asking if we wanted to sell our house, so I squeezed the phone and it broke. I'll buy us a new one.
I changed my mind, I said. Instead of sparring, let's go and take a nice long bath while the kid is asleep. His expression took on a speculative tint. Although with our luck, he'll wake up as we go up the stairs.
I'll carry you, he told me. It will be quieter.
No, it won't.
You stomp like a rhino.
I glide like a silent killer.
His eyes shone.
A cute rhino.
Cute?
Mm-hmm.
See, now you've sealed your fate. I'll have to kill you. He kissed me. It started tender and warm, like wandering through a dark, cold night and finding a warm fire. I sank into it, seduced by the promise of love and warmth. And suddenly it deepened, growing hot, hotter, scorching. His hand slipped into my hair. I leaned against him, eager for the heat.
Get a room!
George called from across the street.
Damn it!
We broke apart. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw George drop a trash bag into the can. She was grinning.
Golden sparks shone in Curran's eyes. So bright his eyes glowed.
Well, how about that?
We are going upstairs and taking that bath, he said. I'm not too proud to beg.
Neither was I, and if he kissed me again, he would find that out.
What if our son wakes up and starts banging on the bathroom door while we're busy in the tub?
I'll threaten to wash him and he'll go right back to sleep.
He took my hand, kissed my fingers, and we went upstairs.
Chapter 8. The problem with having a son who had discovered he was a shapeshifter was twofold. First, Conlon was a hyperactive toddler. Second, lions are cats, and cats like pouncing. They especially like pouncing on their happily sleeping parents and then bouncing up and down on the bed, flexing their claws. It's 6, bounce. In the morning, bounce. I thought, bounce. You hunted in the evening.
We're bounce adaptable. Bounce. Lions are crepuscular. Active in twilight.
Can we make him less active?
Curran grabbed Conlon and pinned him down.
Stop annoying your mother.
Rawr, rawr, rawr.
Why is he shifting all the time? Shouldn't he shift once or twice every 24 hours and then pass out?
He's special,
Curran said, holding Conlon down with one hand. I groaned and put a pillow on my face. We'd had a late night, and it was so worth it. But I could have really used another hour of sleep, or 5.
I can take him to the backyard,
Curran offered. No, I'm up. I crawled out of bed. He must have been too tired from all the shape-changing to wake up last night. Now we're paying for it.
See, there are some benefits to shifting.
Sure. I dragged myself into the bathroom. I would need a big cup of coffee and at least 2 aspirin to make it through the morning. When I came downstairs, Derek and Julie were in our kitchen. The box was still on the table, together with several symbol encyclopedias. I gave Derek a bleary-eyed look of doom. Why are you up?
Curran wants me to come to the guild.
I grabbed a cup of coffee and sat down next to Julie. Anything?
It might be a symbol for intellect in Islamic mysticism. If you break the symbol into blaze symbols, it spells out, very good, doubtful, very good. It may or may not be a part of Illuminati cipher. I'm reasonably sure it's not a hobo sign.
I sighed. We had people being murdered and ancient abominations running through the streets, but yay, at least the hobos weren't about to invade. I looked through the stack of Julie's notes. The symbol looked like something. I just couldn't recall where I'd seen it. Curran walked into the kitchen, carrying Conlon in human baby form. The kid changed shapes faster than I could count.
Roland is preparing for an invasion,